suburban Eastern Australia, an environment that has, over time, evolved some extraordinarily unique groups of Homo sapiens. But today, we observe a small tribe akin to a group of meerkats that gather together atop a small mound to watch, question, and discuss the current events of their city, their country, and their world at large. Let's listen keenly and observe this group, fondly known as the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Yes, hello and welcome, dear listener, episode 421 of this little podcast. As we sit on, we stand up on a mound, look around as meerkats and check out what's going on in the world. I'm Trevor, aka the Iron Fist, with us nearly as always, the Velvet Glove, Scott. You're with us this week.
I'm here with you, Trevor. Yes, I do apologise for last week. It completely slipped my mind.
No problem whatsoever. And Joe, the tech guy, how are you, Joe?
Good.
Very good. If you're in the chat room, say hello. Watley's already there. Redheaded Watley, as we now know. Yeah, so what's on the agenda? We're going to talk a little bit about Australian news. So a bit about long COVID, what the sort of chief medical officer from Queensland had to say. Gina Rinehart getting some free money from the government, GST carve-up. Ideological gender differences, a little bit on essential poll, a little bit about the Pharmacy Guild, a bit about economics and economists sort of acknowledging they don't know what they're doing. And then I really want to have a good chat about TikTok and the proposed ban in the United States and what is that all about. You guys been following that one at all independently or not really?
I did hear about it on a podcast the other day that I was listening to, and I just think to myself, I don't understand. I don't use TikTok or anything like that, so I couldn't tell you what the beat-up's about. But It's one of those things I just think to myself that the Yanks are actually looking at something. They're saying the Chinese own this, therefore the Chinese are out here polluting our political system. So I would have thought that given that Russia has already influenced the American elections using Facebook and everything else, that would be enough for them to say, okay, this is just a new little threat that we've got to deal with on our horizon, rather than actually going, you know, banning it. And then it was even more ridiculous, like when the head of TikTok was in America and that sort of stuff, he appeared before the US Senate. And they said, are you a member of the Chinese Communist Party? He says, I'm Singaporean.
Yes.
And he said, well, have you ever fought with the PLA? He says, I'm Singaporean. You know, they just wouldn't get it through their thick skulls that just because he's yellow doesn't mean that he's Chinese. You know, they are so bloody blinkered over there, aren't they?
Anyway. Did you think to yourself maybe this whole security threat is a complete beat up and there is no security threat?
Absolutely I did, because I thought to myself that, you know, TikTok is something that I think that they limit how long you can actually say a video for, do you?
Yes.
I think so. Yeah.
So they're all short. It's basically death by attention span.
Yes. It's got an excellent algorithm that's got people sucked in.
Hooked for hours at a time.
Yes. I've never used it, but that's my understanding.
It should be banned just because it's so awful, not because of who owns it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into TikTok and examine what exactly is going on there. So you, dear listener, the next time you're at a dinner party and this topic of the TikTok ban comes up, you will be the most informed person in the room by being an IFVG listener. Which I guess you'll just be quite used to that status. I like to think our listeners are the know-it-alls when they're at these social events.
And one would have thought so.
Yeah, hopefully they are. So anyway, that's on the agenda. Maybe we'll talk about Gaza and what's going on there at the same time. So, gentlemen, did you vote in the local government election?
Yes, I did, and I helped count the votes on Saturday night. I'm going back for the next 3 days to also count. So I'm going down to we've got a complicated system up here. We don't have divisions or anything like that. They are all just councillors that are elected for the whole area, and you've got 10 of them. So what you've got to do is you've got to choose 10 on your ballot paper, and there were 29 that were running, so you choose 10. So what you do is you go through, and you've got to actually do this bloody complicated voting counting and all that sort of stuff. When you, they attach them to a clipboard so that they are all on exactly the same same runs and that sort of stuff, and then you run a ruler down. You count the first lot, and you say, well, they haven't got any votes. The next lot's got 2 votes, and then you go down, they got 3 votes, and they got 5 and everything else. You get down until you do that across 60 or 80,000 people.
Wow. And were you there just as a volunteer? Well, you were doing this part-time work sort of thing.
I was getting paid for it. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds complicated. I tried to.
Well, I was just sorting them out into informal and informal votes and that sort of stuff. Then we had to put rubber bands around them in backs of 50. So that's just getting ready for this complicated count process, which is already started. But they rang me up this afternoon. They said, "Can I work for the next 3 days?" I said, "Yes, I can."
So. Yeah, that's good. By the way, dear listener, if you don't want to listen to our chit chat about our lives, then look at the chapters and fast forward to the meaty bits. But we'll just continue with a little chit chat here.
Exactly, because you know, I would have thought that our listeners would love us enough to actually want to know what's happening in our personal lives.
You just never know. I tried to vote down the Gold Coast.
Yeah, and you can't because you're outside of your local area.
Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't know that for local council elections. That you couldn't. I'm so used to doing it for state and federal. Just vote anywhere. Yeah. Walked in and they said, "There's a piece of paper over there. Just write down your name and address and why you couldn't vote." In this day and age, didn't have the technology to allow somebody from Brisbane to vote in the council election if they were in the Gold Coast.
I thought it was a little bit ridiculous too. I got done with that in Rockhampton when I was living there the first time and everything else when there was a council election.
Mm.
And I went down and I said, "Look, I haven't changed my voting address yet. I'm still registered in Brisbane." They said, "Well, you can't vote."
Yeah. So anyway. Just didn't have the paperwork for it.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. What are we grateful for? I'm grateful for squash TV. Dear listener.
Squash TV?
Yes. I play a lot of squash. It keeps me – it's a fantastic sport. If you're looking for a sport that takes your mind off things, keeps you fit, and just the greatest game of all. Well, I signed up to a squash TV subscription maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm totally addicted to it. I don't watch any football or any cricket or any regular sport at all on TV, but I watch a lot of squash TV. So that's what I'm grateful for. You guys grateful for anything?
Well, I'm grateful for my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 subscription television channels that I've got. So. No, I am also grateful that I am progressing in my application for a financial controller's job up here, which would be really good if I get that. So anyway.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Joe, anything? Are you just an ungrateful bastard?
I'm going to say Apple Photos.
Apple Photos.
I scanned 1,000 photos when I was at Mum's place, or rather I had them scanned for me. And I am slowly going through cropping them, setting the black and white colour balance and removing all the finger marks, stains and various detritus and trying to get some semblance of them so that at least they're archived and I've got some notes of them before Mum is no longer around to tell me who these people are.
Mm. So Apple Photos is that just the photos that's on your phone, Apple Photos? Is that
what? Yes.
Right, okay. But it does all
and it's also on my laptop.
Very good. Right, okay. Well, the other thing I'm grateful for is I didn't have to go to the triple conference, Joe, that you told me about. So, dear listener, there was a conference down in Albury called Big Ideas for a Better Australia. Joe sent it to me and said I should check it out. And I could have joined hundreds of like-minded locals, hundreds more from around Australia, as they brought together the best minds as best speakers as offering the best ideas for a better Australia. And they had 3 conferences over 3 days. And on the Friday, it was Freedman Friday. What is freedom? Why is it being eroded and how do we get it back? Australia's premier libertarian conference. That was on the Friday. On the Saturday, we had Church and State Saturday. We cannot serve 2 masters. what should believers do when the government claims to be God? And then finishing off on Sunday was Net Zero Gala Dinner. Say no to Net Zero at the gala launch of this funny but serious campaign. How will you say Net? I think they got about between 50 and 100 people, mostly over 70, Joe. And I don't think it was much of a success, that conference, but thanks for the
hope.
Yes, thanks for the link. Glad I didn't have to go. Long COVID. Article came out, or news reports came out, about the Queensland Chief Health Officer asked for the term long COVID to be scrapped, as new research suggests that it's no more sinister than the long-term effects of the flu. So apparently Queensland's health did research of 5,000 Australians and found the lasting effects of infection from seasonal flu and other respiratory illnesses was about the same for people infected with COVID. And he says, just using that term, long COVID caused unnecessary fear. Was that surprising to you guys that he would come out and say that?
No, I mean, we've known for a couple of years that long COVID is probably a post-viral syndrome, the same as lots of others like ME, CFS, fibromyalgia. There's a whole load of basket case diagnoses that are almost certainly the immune system overreacting to a viral infection.
Mm.
The advantage of long COVID is, one, it's catchy, it's got people's attention, and two, the fact that there are so many cases of it, it's now getting focus on post-viral syndrome as a whole.
Mm.
So I think we need to be recognising that it's not a standalone disease. It's something that's around that has just gone unnoticed and uncared about. And hopefully we'll get a lot more research because more people are affected by this.
If you just read the headline and the first few paragraphs, you would get the impression, oh, they're saying long COVID isn't a thing. But when you read into it, what they're saying is long COVID is a thing, but it's the same as other respiratory viruses and illnesses, and that it does exist, and it's just exists with things that are not COVID as well. So over 16% of respondents reported ongoing symptoms a year later, and 3.6% reported moderate to severe functional impairment. So he's saying that is a thing. It just happens with other virus respiratory yes. illnesses as well. And the other thing that came up in that was that perhaps Australia overall had low rates of long COVID because we were mostly vaccinated and were then exposed to the Omicron variant, which seemed to have less long COVID side effects than the earlier COVID-19 variants. So that might mean that Queensland and Australia is different to other countries who had the earlier versions that had more evidence of long COVID, perhaps.
I think that's probably right because, you know, I first heard about long COVID when I was listening to the Dr. Norman Schwarzkopf. I can't even remember what he's...
Yeah, I know the guy you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dr. Norman... No, not Dr. Norman Swan. I was thinking Norman Schwarzkopf. That was the general that kicked Saddam's ass. Anyway. And I just heard long COVID then, and that scared the living shit out of me. It did scare me, so I can actually understand where they're saying that it leads to alarm. It certainly led to alarm on mine, you know, because I thought to myself, if I get this, I'm going to end up with long COVID for months. But it turned out, you know, I got it. It was over it in 2 days. And then it was only until the next Saturday that I started testing negative so then I could go outside again, you know.
Yep. No doubt, though, you'll run into people, dear listener, who'll say, oh, health guy said long COVID's not a thing. And that's not what he said.
Not the case, yes.
Just got to read these things. There's nuance in there and there's a few interplaying ideas and concepts that you have to get to grip with, so...
I remember arguing about the seasonal flu vaccine, people saying, oh, you know, I always get flu from it, which is a load of rubbish. But also, oh, you know, flu's not that bad. And it's like, if you've never had flu, you'll think it's not that bad. If you've ever really had flu, I was, as a 20-year-old, in bed for 3 weeks, unable to move from the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't surprise me that, yeah, 16% of people who've had real flu are left with long-term effects.
Mm.
And I think that that needs to be the takeaway. Not that long COVID doesn't exist, that all of these diseases can cause long-term effects in a subset of the population, and we need to be doing more to help them.
Mm. Yeah, this is just a classic example where the story isn't straightforward. It requires the interplay of a few different facts to get to the real issue. And I was just looking on a friend's Facebook page the other day where there was sort of anti-climate change people commenting. And it just struck me that they just were incapable of holding several concepts and ideas and interplays together. You know, how come we've got so much snow in winter and other things where, okay, it's because of the extra moisture in the air and the polar vortex is breaking down because of climate change, and just a whole bunch of things where people just need to know a number of different ideas and how they interact with each other in order to get to the truth. Things aren't always just simple, straightforward answers, and I think people really crave for that. They want the simple, straightforward answer.
That there's so Earth has an incredibly moderate temperature range between the poles and the equator because there's basically a water flow around that moves warm water from the equator up to the poles, and there is a fear that if the polar ice caps melt, that water flow will cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that we will get very, very cold winters, certainly in Northern Europe, because Northern Europe is much warmer than the equivalent latitude in the US.
Mm.
East Coast US. Basically, the UK is about the same latitude as Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd expect a similar climate there. And yes, if you get global warming, it melts the ice caps, which interferes with the salinity of the sea, which stops this movement of seawater around, which stops the Gulf Stream happening.
Mm.
But yes, it's fairly...
And the deniers just wanted to throw up their hands and say, well, that's all far too complicated, you're making things up, it can't be true. And
well, exactly.
Yeah, it's frustrating that people look for the simple answers and aren't prepared to put in the work just a little bit to try and understand how things go. So anyway, Gina Reinhart... She has interests in Liontown Resources and Arafura Rare Earths, and the government has given Liontown Resources $230 million in government agency loans, and Australian Rare Earths received $840 million in loans and straight handouts to develop a lithium mine.
She's going to hand it back because she's a believer in small government.
Yeah, that's right. This is the woman who says government should get out of people's lives. Except when it's an $840 million handout to her mine. Just why are we not, after all of our experience, saying, oh, yeah, okay, developing a lithium mine's a great idea. Here's our $840 million. How many shares do we get in the company for that rather than these loans? It's just a repetition of mistakes.
And then, you know, and then if that $840 million down the track turns out to be $1.6 billion, then we can sell it.
Yep.
And we can sell those shares to the private markets, and then they end up with flooding with money back into our coffers. It's very frustrating that, you know, everyone – I know socialism got a bad rap over many years because the government was too involved in the economy, but – it's not as evil as that would make out, because that $840 million could end up being $1.6 billion in a relatively short period of time.
Mm.
However, with the rare earths and all that sort of stuff, you know, what was the latest miner that's gone belly up over lithium? Anyway, yeah.
Not sure.
The big thing with capitalism is externalities.
Yeah.
So you don't factor in the true cost to the society as a whole.
Mm.
You're only the business, it only costs, it counts in its immediate costs.
Mm.
And the cleanup and all the rest of that is left for other people to pick up the bill.
Exactly. Which is ridiculous.
So, a decent system of capitalism would factor in externalities as well.
Hmm. Well, dear listener, Mariana Mazzucato wrote a book which detailed the inventions made by various US government agencies and how that technology was then used by Apple and other groups, and really other sort of loans that were given to people like Elon Musk and others, where really the government should have taken an equity stake in what they were providing, because it was risky sort of loans that they were given, and they could have got it, but they didn't. They just got loans that were, they made loans which were quickly repaid, and the entrepreneurs made billions as a result.
Mm-hmm. This is also true of science as a whole. Mm. So the vast majority of science is government funded, but all the papers that are written are published and owned by private journals.
Mm.
And so although the government has funded the science that is leading to these articles, you can't access the articles that your taxes have paid for.
We did a section on that 300 episodes ago, I reckon it was.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Anyway, that was Gina Reinhart, a beneficiary of largesse from the government. And, of course, in the lead-up to the next election, she will fund as many people as she can to get rid of Labor. So why would they agree to it in the first place? She's not going to be a friend as a result.
I've got a very low opinion of Mrs. Reinhart.
But it's all right. Mr. Potato Head flew across to WA for her birthday.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Didn't he pay for that, or was that paid for by her?
Allegedly, he paid for it.
Right.
Okay.
Certainly, he claims the taxpayer didn't. Mm. Although I think the taxpayer had to pay you for his security detail.
In the chat room, John says, I know a science YouTube blogger that has been bedridden with long COVID for 2 years now. Watley says, Al Gore was saying that about the Gulf Stream in 1996. Liam says, that's the spirit, Comrade Scott. There we go.
I am not a socialist, all right? Yep. I have some sympathy for it, though, but I am not a card-carrying socialist.
And Motley says, largesse is a good word for Gina Reinhart. Boom, boom, Motley. Right. Did I miss any from earlier? Grateful for Pewter. And Liam's grateful that Scott is a Greens voter. Oh, there we go.
Hey, I've got a bone to pick with you, Liam. Right? I will give Trevor permission to give you my phone number so I can have a go at you over the Greens Maud Merrill candidate down there in Brisbane. All right.
What do you mean you want to have a go? What was Srinath or whatever your name is?
Well, I can't remember what her name was. I just thought it was ridiculous how she actually attended that protest over that woman that was being kicked out of her house when they didn't actually look into it to find out that the woman owed, you know, 100 days worth of rent or something like that. This is despite the fact that the tenant was being charged below market rate for rent and everything else. And the guy wanted to sell the place so that he could fund his 102-year-old mother to go into a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And the Greens said, that sounds like the hill we're going to die on.
Yes, but property is theft, Scott.
Sorry.
It's not theft, because what they wanted to do, they were going to sell that Salisbury place to someone else that thinks to himself, oh, yeah, this is 1,000 square metres, bang in goes the bulldozers and up goes a 6 or 7 pack of units.
Are you expecting, you're expecting perfection, Scott?
Oh, I am, because these people do hold themselves up as perfection and they are not.
Liam, in the chat, give us your response to that tirade. We'll get that going as we keep talking. Right.
I can't see the chat right now.
Why can't you see the chat?
I don't know.
Any reason why? Oh, it's not on the screen.
Yeah. Wasn't turned on. I don't know why.
Yeah, forgot all about that. There we go. Mm-hmm. But there we go. There's the chat. Nobody told us about that. So, okay, now you can see it, Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Don't apologise. It's fine.
GST carve-up, so it's come out about what each state is going to get, and Queensland and New South Wales are complaining about the amount that they're getting. You remember we did a story about Saul Eslake describing how Western Australia cut a GST deal that, in his words, is the worst Australian public policy decision of the 21st century, meaning it's worse than AUKUS submarines. So that's saying something. And anyway, Queensland, New South Wales complaining about how much they've got. Deputy Opposition Leader Jared Blaige says Queensland had been dudded by the federal Labor government. Why is Stephen Miles not screaming from the rooftop like I've seen him do before when it was a coalition government? It's because the formulas are all set previously.
One of those things, I think they've actually got to sit down and work out some kind of formula that would keep them basically happy because, you know,
the formula gets bastardised because of political interests.
Yeah, I know, it gets bastardised by political interests, which is where it goes wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can understand why New South Wales feels aggrieved because they have they've never got one for one of the GST back that they put into it. I can understand that. However, Tasmania would be an absolute basket case if you gave them only back what they had achieved for GST, you know. It's...
We just want a fair and equitable system where those who are doing well subsidise those who aren't.
And then you've got that situation that WA had to, you know, because of the mining boom and everything else, they had a hell of a lot of money going to their royalties. So that affected their GST carve-up, which is why Costello, not Costello, who was it? Morrison got involved and said, no, we can't do that.
So I think basically Western Australia almost got to the point where it was getting 12 cents for every dollar, of GST that it actually collected. And then Morrison chipped in to say, well, we'll have a new rule that a state must receive at least 70 cents for every dollar that it provides. And then to keep the other states happy, there was a no state will be worse off provision put into it. And initially that was estimated to cost X billions of dollars. And, of course, that's just blown out fivefold and it's now going to cost the budget a huge amount in terms of sending the states more money than they actually collect because of that provision. So I'm not exactly sure what happened in this particular case. It seemed like Queensland and New South Wales had done really well out of royalties and Victoria hadn't. In any event, it's all very political, the formula. And shit fights to continue down the track, as always.
I think they said that Victoria had shut down a bunch of coal mines.
Okay, so that's why their royalties depleted.
Yes.
That's why they needed particular assistance. There you go. Yeah. Right. Joe, you sent me this one from the Financial Times. Sorry,
why did Victoria shut down their coal mines? Was it coal they were extracting?
Yeah, I think it's the aging power stations and they're shutting down.
Gotcha. Coal. No worries.
Okay.
All right.
Liam says he's not perfect, but no one is, and maybe he got that wrong. I have no idea. There we go.
So Liam's not going to face me over the phone, huh?
What's there to say? Do you want to say any more than what you've just said?
No, I don't think so. That's fine.
Saved everyone a phone call. Ideological differences. This one came from Joe from the showing article in the Financial Times. So how should we make sense of reports that Gen Z is hyper-progressive on certain issues but surprisingly conservative on others? And I think Gen Z is supposed to be the under 30s. The answer, in the words of Elise Evans from Stanford University, is that today's under 30s are undergoing a great gender divergence, with young women in the progressive camp and young men in the conservative camp. So Gen Z is two generations, not one. And she says this happens in countries on every continent, that there's this ideological gap between young men and women. In the US, Gallup data shows women aged 18 to 30 are now 30% or 30 percentage points more liberal than their male contemporaries, and that this gap has really opened up in the last 6 years. Germany shows a 30-point gap. UK, 25 points. Poland, almost half the men aged 18 to 21 backed the hard-right Confederation Party compared to just a sixth of young women of the same age. There's a graph. And outside the West, there's even more stark divisions. South Korea, similar case in China. So in the US, UK and Germany, young women now take far more liberal positions on immigration and racial justice than young men. There we go. Any surprises there, gentlemen?
No, not at all.
Right. Liam, are you our representative? Well, you're not under 30, are you, Liam? You're a bit older than that. You might know some under 30s. Do you find that your male Gen Z friends are conservative, more conservative than your female friends? Let us know, Liam, or anyone else.
I find that young men are more impacted by the social justice causes and are more likely to react negative.
Mm.
Is that because of, what's the word I'm groping for? The
Jordan Peterson?
Well, Jordan Peterson's probably part of it. But what was that guy? What was that influencer that?
The guy's been arrested.
The guy that's been arrested and is in
custody. Oh, Andrew Tate.
Andrew Tate, yeah. Is that because of him?
They're all symptoms.
Mm. Okay.
So the push for equality, there's an argument that basically a lot of young men are feeling disaffected, talked down at, being held up as the reasons that they are guilty of the sins of the past, that sexism in the past, that the inequality in number of women in high paying positions has led to men being disproportionately overlooked for any form of promotion or any form of career advancement. And I think there are a lot of angry young men because of that.
Mm.
So,
yeah, I could see that as a response in some.
I could see that as a response, but I don't think it's a particularly fair response.
Maybe not, but I think that's part of it. And a lot of the social justice is you're white, you're male, you're privileged.
Mm.
I can agree with that. That is a lot of that is coming across, you know.
And that's why I think it's more men than women that are being picked up by the right wing.
Yeah.
Mm. Good thinking, Joe. Probably right there.
Yeah, historically the left, as we've said, the left, political left, has deserted the working class.
Mm. Absolutely, they have.
And I think this is why the right wing are picking up. And the women aren't so enthralled by it because a lot of it is very much women should be in the kitchen popping babies out one after the other.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm. Right. Well, I've got a poll from Essential Poll and looking at Australia's role in global affairs. So which of the following is closest to your view on what Australia's role should be in global affairs? And first option was primarily an ally of the US. The second option was an independent middle power. Third was B, Australia just should not engage in world affairs. And the fourth option was unsure. And so the conservative position would be, I would have thought, primarily an ally of the US. And in terms of age,
it's not that much difference.
Well, the 18 to 34s were the most likely.
24%. But, you know, and they end up at 55 plus, you're now at 19%. That's only a 5% difference.
Yeah. I would have expected a bigger amount of the older people.
Of the older, yeah, exactly.
There was a surprising number of younger people to be more willing to see Australia as an ally of the US than older people.
Mm.
That kind of surprised me. So,
see, what is very comforting about this is that you've got the independent middle power. You know, they've come up there at 34% on the 18 to 35, 34, 32% in the 35 to 54, and then 48% in the 55s plus.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so a surprising number of young people willing to see Australia as an ally of the US. And then in terms of gender, males, 26%. Wanting to see Australia as an ally of the US, female only 14%. So that's all ages, but definitely more of a male thing to be. Putting those two together, male and young, more likely to take the conservative, what I would have thought is the conservative approach of seeing Australia as an ally of the US rather than independent. Anyway, still on Essential Poll, looking at Australia's relationship with China, and seeing it as a positive opportunity, seeing it as a complex relationship to be managed, and seeing it as a threat. And 67% said it's complicated to be managed. 20% said it's a threat. And is that 13%?
87%.
Yeah. 13% said it is an opportunity. That's sort of overall. But looking by gender, males were more likely to see it as a threat, 16%, as opposed to females, 10%. So it's views on our relationship with China that males see it more as a threat than females do. And this one, this is all Australian, by the way. Views on Israel's military action in Gaza. Which of the following is closest to your view on Israel's military action in Gaza? First one, Israel is justified in its military action. Second, Israel should agree to a temporary ceasefire. Third option was Israel should permanently withdraw. Fourth option was unsure. And 18% of Australians think Israel is justified in continuing its military action. 20% say they should ceasefire temporarily. And 37% say withdraw permanently. 18%, go ahead, Israel, do what you're doing. Have these people know.
I just don't think they give a shit, do they, you know?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to have to, I've got slight reading. I've got a problem with my eyes. Well, I can read a book fine. I can see in the distance fine. Arm's length where a computer screen is where I'm just struggling a fraction. Just so I can see what like these graphs. Break that down by gender, and males, 26%, are saying, go ahead, Israel, keep doing what you're doing, it's justified. Whereas only 11% of females would say the same thing. So those three issues definitely show significant gender differences, I think, in the way Australians think, which is kind of in line, Joe, with the previous article saying that at least in Gen Z, women more likely to be progressive, men more likely to be conservative.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm.
Mm. Do you guys remember how the Pharmacy Guild was really upset when the government allowed 60-day prescriptions? So rather than having to get a script for 30 days, you could get a 60-day script and it was just, they'd be ruined.
Mm-hmm.
Reports have come out that 7 new pharmacies have started up since that change took place, which is a 50% uptick from the same time last year. So presumably not the problem that the Pharmacy Guild was suggesting it would be if it's actually a huge uptick in pharmacies compared to the same time last year.
Mm. Well, I'd like to see a longer period of time than just 1 year, but yes.
There we go. We're rattling through some topics here on our way to TikTok. There's a Nobel laureate economist, Angus Deaton, has delivered a rebuke to his own profession. What are his credentials? He's an economic doyen from Central Casting, a bow-tie-wearing econometrician, PhD at Cambridge. He's been at Princeton for 40 years. He's currently the Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs Emeritus. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2015. And according to this article in Crikey, he's just dropped an almighty bucket of shit on his entire profession. So he lobs a bunch of truth bombs, saying that he's had a changing of his mind about economics that he's practiced for over half a century. And largely he was saying that we've stopped in economics thinking about ethics and what constitutes human well-being, and that if economists just focus on efficiency and leave equity to others, then our recommendations become little more than a license for plunder. And he says historians who understand about contingency and multiple and multidirectional causality. Who's that? What's that noise there?
That's me, Rainy.
Oh, right. Okay. Wow, that's bucketing down.
It is, yeah. But it'll stop very shortly.
Okay. where are we? Yes, you've just moved. That's good. Historians who understand about contingency and multiple and multi-direction causality often do a better job than economists. And he talks about the shame that unions have disappeared because they contributed to a wages share for working people. But his main point is about power. He says, our emphasis on the virtues of free competitive markets and exogenous technical change can distract us from the importance of power in setting prices and wages, in choosing the direction of technological change, and in influencing politics to change the rules of the game. So this economist has suddenly discovered power, and as Bernard Keane in Crikey says, Deaton has only belatedly realised modern capitalism, particularly in its neoliberal form that disempowers governments and rivals like trade unions, is about the use of power by corporations to change the rules of the game, to increase certainty for themselves and to reduce it for competitors, workers and consumers. It speaks volumes about how sheltered many mainstream academic economists really are. So, yeah, a Nobel laureate for economics dropping the almighty bucket of shit on his profession, saying they haven't taken into account power imbalance enough. And
I just hear the name and think of the presenter of Have I Got News For You in the UK.
Angus Deaton, is that his name?
Yes. Who got into trouble for his frequenting of prostitutes and use of cocaine, I think, was the...
Well, because I've been saying for a while now that economics is just this dark art rather than a true science, and it's been dressed up with mathematical models to try and make something sciencey out of it, but they've really got some fundamental things wrong in economics, and the experiments have been run and people are now starting to realise what a shitty sort of advice we've been getting from economists on the whole over the last 100-odd years.
The Chicago School especially.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of myth-busting to happen with economics, I think. So,
and certainly in terms of power, there's been arguments that Alphabet and Apple, who were two of the largest, yeah, they have economies that are bigger than
countries.
Two-thirds of the world's countries. And obviously they have a unnatural effect in terms of international affairs and international, you know, just the sheer amount of money that and they can make or break a country.
Yep. And just the fundamental need for young economies need protections and artificial protectionism in order to nurture new industries and to keep multinational competitors out while they get a manufacturing or an industrial economy going. And that's one of the most fundamental misunderstandings people have, that they think, oh, you just need to open up these third world economies to allow them, you know, to enter the free market and allow the free market to enter them and efficiencies will develop. But America was, and successful countries were built on initial protectionism that they could get their industries underway. And then once they were underway, they were like, oh, well, we should be opening up to the entire world.
Yeah.
Because they'd got their scale by then.
If you actually, I sort of disagree with what you're saying there, because if you actually allow them to lock themselves away from the international market and that type of thing, is it for a temporary period or is that for a longer period? Because I would have thought
as long as necessary for the industry to gain its foothold and its expertise.
Okay, so Australia, when should we have dropped our manufacturing when should we have dropped our manufacturing tariffs on our clothing and textile industry?
Well, if we wanted to keep, if the plan was to keep that industry and develop it in a way that we could eventually be competitive on the world stage, however long that takes. But that was never the plan. And what you're looking at there is Australia was an advanced economy that moved into service delivery and abandoned manufacturing. But thinking of places like Latin America, where they're essentially agricultural economies who might want to develop a manufacturing base, start making washing machines or cars or something. Okay, you can't run those industries while multinationals can import cheap product. You have to give that protection while that local industry develops expertise. And then once they've got the expertise, they can compete, which is exactly what China did.
Yeah, okay. Now, if we just take the example of China and Mexico right now, because Donald Trump has already threatened that if he's elected and that sort of stuff, he will slap a 100% tariff on Chinese cars that are manufactured in Mexico before they cross the border into the US.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't understand what Mexico could have done to avoid that type of thing, because they have followed the rules. They have done exactly what they've been told. They have developed a manufacturing industry down there, and now they're exporting stuff to the US.
Well, what's happened is that the US banned Chinese or put on huge tariffs on Chinese imports.
Yeah, I understand
that. And so Mexico has become a backdoor for Chinese trade. Right. So when you look at the graphs of Chinese trade into America, on the face of it, it's dropped. But if you then take into account the increase that's gone through via Mexico, it's clearly been operating as a backdoor Chinese imports.
Do you support Donald Trump if he's saying he wants to slap a 100% tariff on those cars?
Look,
like he wants the BYD car and that sort of stuff, because that is what's scaring the shit out of the American car manufacturers right now, is because BYD is talking about producing a car in Mexico and then they're going to sell it over into the US for around about $25,000, which is significantly lower than what a Tesla is selling for.
Mm. If any country wants to put in a tariff regime to protect an industry that it sees as vital to its interests, go right ahead. But don't complain when other countries do it as well. That isn't the point.
This is the whole bloody problem. If you get into a trade war and that sort of stuff, that, you know, everyone's just slapping tariffs on, and it's...
So the reason you might want to keep a manufacturing base up is in case of war.
Or pandemic, when you can't make a ventilator...
And you
can't transport them. Yes. Like, we couldn't make ventilators. If we had some manufacturing capacity, we might have been able to say.
Yeah, okay. Well, I can understand that. I can understand that you're going to have, you know, that sort of thing is that it's a very specialized piece of equipment, that type of thing. It's just, I think you could actually argue that that's got to be protected over here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so convinced that the car industry deserves protection.
Well, and the argument was during the Second World War, the car manufacturers turned their hands to producing tanks.
We didn't have a car manufacturing company in Australia.
I mean, the reason why US and Europe might want to protect their manufacturing base and not have it shipped all off to China, for instance, is that in the case of a war, sure, you've got your whatever stock of tanks now. But if you needed to ramp up and do what the Russians did in the Second World War, we just don't have the capability of doing that.
If you demand free trade, then you're essentially making it easy for the existing powerful players to remain powerful, because they can just come in and squash any newcomers before they get going. So protectionism is fine if your ultimate game is to protect the industry until it becomes efficient enough to compete, or even if it doesn't become efficient enough to compete, but in the national interests, you think you need a subsidised manufacturing industry, for example, that just for your balance of your economy and security because of war or pandemic or other things, you need to keep certain industries and you're prepared to pay the subsidies. So just the sort of freedom of movement of global international goods is great when you're the powerful, dominant player who goes around squashing people, which is what's been happening. And that's what the IMF and the World Bank did to so many developed, well, developing countries, third world countries in the south. It said, here's a loan, but the condition is you've got to allow outside entrants to come in and sell whatever into your country. You're really good at making, at growing bananas. So you keep growing bananas and leave washing machines and cars to other countries. And that's why they never got manufacturing industries. And countries like America did exactly that. They put in tariffs and restrictions to protect their infant industries until they got big enough that they didn't need it. That's the story of economics.
Yeah, I know. That's the history lesson of it, but I just don't think that you can say to any emerging economy and that sort of stuff that you can protect your industries right now and then in 10 or 20 years' time you've got to wind back your tariffs, because I just think to myself that they're not going to bother. Because once they've got their manufacturing and everything up and they're employing the numbers of people that are required for that type of thing, I just don't think that they're going to be interested in lowering their tariff barriers.
If they want to export, so you build up your manufacturing base and you've tapped out your national market and you want to expand overseas, then you start doing, you know, tit for tat. If I want to export to the US, which is a huge market, then I have to, you know, allow traffic in reverse.
So other countries will say, no, not allowing your goods in because you've got these tariffs here. So at some point the country goes, well, we're just going to pay that price because it's in our interests, or it becomes politically unsavoury. So Australia made the decision we didn't want to subsidise a clothing manufacturing industry. There wasn't the will to do it, so we let it go. There we go. I'm sure in this article, let me just find it here, that we just talked about this Nobel laureate, talked about multinationals, can't find it. Anyway, and just finally, still from Crikey, the Reserve Bank trashed the economy, and for what? And basically that yesterday's, well, now this must be an old article, the December quarter national accounts from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, so from the ABS, information came out to say that in December, quarter-on-quarter growth was just 0.2%. In per capita terms, the economy contracted by 0.8% in the December quarter. So Bullock and the RBA board had made a call to increase interest rates. At the time, retail sales were up 1.5% in November. But the ABS said that's because consumers are feeling the stress and they're taking advantage of discounting by retailers during Black Friday and other events. It's not because it's a buoyant economy. It's because shoppers are getting in early on discounts. And that's why sales were up 1.5% in November, which the Reserve Bank took for a buoyant economy that needed a further whack around the head. And in fact, what happened was sales slid 2.1% in the normally buoyant month of December. And as I said in the Crikey article, it's a pretty sorry state of affairs when the country's statisticians, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, can see what's happening to an important area of household spending while the so-called premier economic analysts at the Reserve Bank make desperate consumers for an overheating economy. Sorry, what's that, Joe?
I'm waiting for them to say, well, this is a per capita problem, and so we just need to do some decapitation and solve the problem.
Yes, that's probably what they'd come out with. So just hopeless at the RBA, people buying up in – the ABS proves that it was people buying in November because they were broke, getting something cheap, and the RBA took that for a buoyant economy that needed a whack around the head. And our stupid treasurer, Jim Chalmers, wanted to get rid of the reserve power that allowed the government in emergencies to override the Reserve Bank on monetary policy. For God's sake. Right. 8:59. We've gone an hour and we're only just getting to TikTok. Well, it's going to be a long one. Ah, I find this TikTok thing to basically encapsulate the world we're in at the moment. So let... Anybody got to go anywhere? You get reaching for a second beer there, Scott, are you?
Yeah.
Settle in. let me find a video to set the scene for the TikTok fiasco. This, dear listener, is, who is this lady? Ashley Hinson, Republican, proud mum and wife representing Iowa in Congress. And she's bringing a dose of Iowa common sense to Washington. Well, that's how she describes herself in her Twitter profile. So let's see the mood amongst congressmen and women in America when it comes to TikTok and your average person in Iowa.
Well, hi, everyone. This is your Congresswoman Ashley Hinson. As a mom of two boys in middle school, I understand the challenges surrounding kids' social media use. And as a member of Congress, I can tell you that TikTok is a Chinese Trojan horse used to steal Americans' data. It's used to control the narrative on key issues in our country and to hurt our kids' mental health. So that's why I helped to introduce legislation that would force TikTok to cut ties with its parent company, ByteDance, a company that is beholden to China. They'd have to do this in order to keep operating in the U.S. Now, as many of you have heard, TikTok is spreading a lot of misinformation. They're telling users that we in Congress are going to ban TikTok. They took it way too far last week by sending out a push alert to young kids, prompting pure panic about the app's future. So let me set the record straight. We are working in Congress to pass legislation to protect your privacy, protect our national security, and to keep your phone safe from hacks. We are working to ensure that China does not control the content that you see. TikTok wants you to think they get you, but they're working hard to control you and to control what you think. ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company, is tracking your keystrokes, your passwords, and your phone activity to advance China's intelligence and influence in the U.S. So think about it like a Chinese spy balloon right in your phone. It's pretty simple. All TikTok has to do is to sever ties with China to keep their American users. So I am proud to lead this effort and will continue working to ensure that China cannot exert control over our country or continue hurting our kids through TikTok. The time is up for this Chinese spyware.
There you go. It's just like a Chinese spy balloon, guys. And what did we find out about Chinese spy balloons?
They definitely exist.
But they weren't spying on anything. It was a complete beat-up. To say that this is just like the Chinese spy balloon, that was the only thing she said that was correct. That was the only thing that – and she it is exactly like a Chinese spy balloon.
I understand that.
Complete bullshit.
The Chinese spy balloon was shot down by the Yanks and that sort of stuff, and I agreed wholeheartedly with them because something blew off course and all that sort of stuff. It invaded U.S. airspace, so they had to take it out, so they shot it down.
It accidentally crossed U.S. space. U.S. airspace. It didn't invade U.S. airspace.
Okay, whatever. It accidentally found its way there. They had to shoot it down, so it was shot down. That was it.
Mm.
Now, the whole thing was the Yanks were very secretive about it and all that sort of stuff. It made them look like idiots, you know, because I think once you finally found out what was on the spy balloon, they found out it was nothing.
Which is what the case is when it comes to TikTok as well.
Yeah, I know. It's also, you know, when I was listening to her nonsense where she said that, you know, they're in there stealing your passwords and all that sort of shit, I just thought to myself, Jesus Christ, you know, this woman's a nut.
Mm. It's one of the few things that Congress has agreed on very quickly in recent times. I know. So they've come together.
She's a nut.
Well, to pass legislation
to ban TikTok.
To force a change of ownership of TikTok, otherwise it's not allowed to operate in the US. So,
yeah, because they're concerned that TikTok is losing market share.
Yes. Well, it's this McCarthyism of, you know, Reds under the bed, you know, Chinese under your phone.
Is ByteDance owned by the Chinese government or not?
Well, we're going to get to that. So, Okay. Well, let me actually give you the exact bit on that. So this is according to the TikTok website. But I think we can take this sort of factual information as being true. So, myth, TikTok's parent company ByteDance is Chinese owned. And they say fact. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, was founded by Chinese entrepreneurs, but today roughly 60% of the company is owned by global institutional investors such as the Carlyle Group, General Atlantic and Susquehanna International Group. So 60% international. An additional 20% of the company is owned by ByteDance employees around the world, including Australians, and the remaining 20% is owned by the company's founder, who is a private individual and is not part of any state or government entity. So the parent company ByteDance owns, well, and TikTok doesn't operate in mainland China. There's a different software, I'll get to the name of it in a second, which they control but which runs in China.
Oh, that's WeChat, isn't it?
No, it is. Oh. Let me just see here. It is Douyin, D-O-U-Y-I-N. So that's the Chinese version of TikTok. And so no TikTok in China. Instead, they're using Douyin. And the Chinese government owns 1% of Douyin. That's what it owns. So for ByteDance itself that owns TikTok, no, 60% international, 20% employees, 20% the original Chinese founder. ByteDance owns Douyin and the Chinese government owns 1%. And it does that because if you have a media organisation in China, then the government by law has to own 1% as part of
Wikipedia
media.
Wikipedia says this is a golden share which allows it to outvote everybody else on the board.
And in Douyin or in ByteDance?
In ByteDance.
Yeah, and that is a myth. So let me just see what they say here. So myth, the Chinese government has a golden share interest in ByteDance. And the fact, as required under Chinese law, in order to operate certain news and information products that are exclusively in China, media licenses are required for those services. As such, an entity affiliated with the Chinese government owns 1% of the ByteDance subsidiary Douyin. And it says this is a common arrangement for companies operating news and information platforms in China. This arrangement is specific to services in the Chinese market and has no bearing on ByteDance's global operations outside of China, including TikTok, which does not operate in mainland China. So who do we believe? Wikipedia or the TikTok,
the company that possibly has an interest in telling you.
Yeah, but the author like of the government. Author of the Wikipedia article, who do we know?
Wikipedia has to reference, so it references a Reuters article and a couple of others.
And you could probably jump onto Wikipedia and write the contrary article based on the reference to TikTok's own public statements. I'm prepared to go with the TikTok version, but we'll see. So that gives you a little picture anyway. TikTok is the non-Chinese version. Douyin is the Chinese version. And this guy on TikTok, on Twitter, Brendan Carr, was saying, in America, TikTok pushes videos to kids that promote self-harm, eating disorders and suicide. In China, the version of TikTok available there, the app shows young kids science experiments, museum exhibits and other educational material. And a guy I follow a lot on Chinese stuff is Arnaud Bertrand, and he says this is false. There's been lots of scandals in China about Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, and the harm it did to kids, including a scandal about a famous influencer who live-streamed her suicide and a scandal about eating disorders, which is why, contrary to the US, the Chinese government legislated Douyin and put in all sorts of limitations in terms of content, moderation, number of hours kids could be on it, etc. TikTok in the US, it's down to the US legislators. If they wanted to, US legislators could implement the exact rules as China. There'd be absolutely nothing that prevents them to do so. In fact, TikTok was created for this very reason, because the mother company ByteDance knew that given the ecosystems and culture in China and the rest of the world were so completely different, you simply could not have the same app. So Douyin was to be regulated by the Chinese government and adapted to Chinese citizens. TikTok was to be regulated by the West and adapted to their citizens. And he says it's not China's fault if the US doesn't take their regulation job seriously. So, Joe, when it comes to like the golden share that allows China to do whatever it wants, Chinese company can do whatever it wants with a company in China anyway, without a share. Like they can just say you're going to do this, even if they don't even own a share. They don't need it for things that happen in China.
US government do the same in the US.
Yeah, so the sort of the idea of this golden share is kind of a bit red herring, if you like, because we're talking about power. And when it comes to things happening in China, the Chinese government can do whatever they like, golden share or not, in terms of regulating what companies do in China.
The question is, do they have control over the parent company?
And if the parent company's operations are outside of China, then you'd have to say that would be difficult to do. So
yes, but if the board operate, because the head office is in China.
No, it's
not. So if the board are in China.
No, it's not. So the head office is in Singapore.
Singapore.
Is it?
Yeah. So
that's where the CEO is. He's Singaporean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's got established in Los Angeles and Singapore. So just a few more bits about ByteDance. Well, actually, let me just go back to we're still talking about image, that sort of stuff. Decisions about TikTok are made in Beijing. And here's their response. TikTok CEO is a third-generation Singaporean based in Singapore. He oversees all key day-to-day and strategic decision-making when it comes to TikTok. The COO, Guy Pappas, is an Australian based in the United States. He oversees content, operations, marketing and product teams for TikTok. The senior leadership team is based in Singapore, the United States and Ireland. As would be expected, with any subsidiary of a holding company, high-level discussions around financial matters and corporate governance are made in concert with ByteDance board and the CEO. None of those individuals reside in mainland China. So what they say here is it's an entertainment app. The content of TikTok is generated by the community. So it's up to the community to generate the content. And the secret sauce of TikTok is, of course, the algorithm that keeps people in there watching it. And it says here, there are no TikTok content moderators in China. Content moderation on TikTok is overseen by a Singapore, US and Ireland-led trust and safety teams. It says the myth that the Chinese government could compel ByteDance to share Australian TikTok user data. And it says Australian TikTok user data is stored in Singapore, Malaysia and the US, subject to local laws. TikTok does not store user data in China and has not shared Australian user data with the Chinese government and would not even if it asked. But apparently my understanding is that the reason Facebook and Twitter don't operate in China is because the Chinese said, we don't want you storing Chinese citizen data outside of China. And Facebook and the rest refused, so that's why they don't operate in China. So the concerns that the West has, the data is held in China and the Chinese will get their hands on it and cause problem for our citizens, is wrong. The data is not held in China. But that's the same concern that China had about Facebook. Interesting sort of switch up there. So what else have we got here in the myth versus facts section? Okay, that was the main myth versus fact stuff. Just on, you know, everything from China is a security threat. There was an article from the New York Times, headline, Biden calls Chinese electric vehicles a security threat. There's an article from the BBC, Chinese garlic is a national security risk, says US Senator. An article from the Wall Street Journal, Pentagon sees giant cargo cranes as possible Chinese spying tools. An article from, I can't read that one. China may be spying on you through your coffee maker, expert says. I think that's news. Cool. New York Times, fearing spy trains, Congress may ban a Chinese maker of subway cars. And, of course, we all know about the Chinese spy balloon. So,
well, in terms of the cars, I would be worried. I'm worried about Tesla. Apparently, Tesla have shut down the cars of people who've been critical.
Right.
So there's been some really weird stuff going on. Basically, all these modern cars phone home for every electronic thing that they do.
Right.
I have a friend who works on the integration piece of all the electronic, all the control systems, all the drive-by-wire systems all go through. And he says all functions now literally phone back to the main server, the manufacturer's server,
yep,
for permission before they'll enable a module.
Right.
So you remember BMW famously were going to charge for heated seats.
Well,
you were going to have to subscribe and pay so many dollars a year to have your heated seats turn on.
Yes, I do. Yes, we did that story.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 So all new cars, basically, every function that you press an electronic button on the dashboard, it phones home to find out whether you're allowed to do that before it'll do that.
Mm.
And all of these manufacturers, if they so choose, could turn off your car remotely.
Mm.
And they're saying worse than that, if these cars are in an area where they have no mobile coverage and lose battery power, so they've lost their settings, when you power them back up and they can't phone home to find out whether you're allowed to do anything, the car won't even start.
Mm. See, there's an argument, though, if you accept that these social platforms are going to collect all this data on you, if you want to use one and you're American, you'd be better off using TikTok because the Chinese government has no control over you, whereas the US government does. So if they were all gathering data about you and you were worried about them using it against you, you'd actually rather someone like the Chinese have it than the Americans, because they've got no jurisdiction over you, if that makes sense. Just in terms of what they collect, they say TikTok's privacy policy describes the data the company collects. To be clear, the current versions of TikTok app do not monitor keystrokes or content of what people type when they use our in-app browser or third-party websites, and do not collect precise GPS location in Australia. We only collect approximate location information to ensure a relevant user experience, including being served the right ads, and that does not use face or voice prints to identify individuals. I remember when we were talking about this not so long ago, where TikTok basically said to the authorities, come and look at our software, come and look under the hood, come and see that what we're saying is true. We're just not going to let you look at the algorithm that determines how things show up in front of people. But all this sort of stuff, you can look at our coding to confirm what we're saying is true. So do you remember us talking about that or not? Is that just my imagination?
I don't remember us talking about that.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll try and find that somewhere because I'm sure we talked about that. Anyway, guess what opposition leader Peter Dutton wants to do?
He wants to ban TikTok in Australia, just like the US does. He's a dickhead.
Correct. Yep. Looking at hashtags on TikTok, This was in a 7-day period to December 2023. So hashtags on TikTok. The top, well, Free Palestine, 82 million. Free Palestine with a love heart emoji and a Palestinian flag, 35.4 million. I'll then give you the next sort of most popular hashtags on the topic of Palestine, Gaza, Israel. Free Gaza, Free Palestine, Palestine TikTok, Save Gaza, Stand with Palestine, I Stand with Palestine, From the River to the Sea, Save Palestine, End the Occupation, Pray for Palestine, Palestine Will Be Free. They're all pro-Palestinian. The first hashtag that then comes up is I Stand with Israel, with 2 million hashtags. So the views on something like Israel and Hamas on TikTok are very much pro-Palestine, which might be a reason you think to get rid of it from the US point of view. But apparently Facebook and Instagram show remarkably similar gap when it comes to their hashtags. On Facebook, the hashtag Free Palestine is found on more than 11 million posts, 39 times more than those with hashtag Stand with Israel. So that's interesting that even the other ones are very pro-Palestine compared to Israel. So TikTok's actually not that out of place.
It's one of those things. I just think to myself that this is what I was saying when I was last on here, when I said that this is leading to a change of the opinion about Israel. Mm. You know, it's, I'm not surprised to read that, that you've got all these pro-Palestinian hashtags, you know, From the River to the Sea is the only one that offends me, but, you know, all the rest of them are fine.
Mm. So I read an article. I'll have a look at the comments by people in a moment, but just last couple of things on this. So as you know, dear listener, one of the pains I go through on your behalf is to read the Courier Mail, the Courier Fail religiously. If that's not worth signing up to the Patreon for, I don't know what is.
Did you get it delivered in paper or did you just go grab digital, it electronic?
Electronic, yeah. So this article from the Courier Mail, clock is ticking to block TikTok, and story about, you know, obviously the US decision, and now Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill in the government, she said, we're monitoring the progress of the bill in the US and will take additional action if and when relevant agencies advise it is appropriate to do so. For God's sake, Labor, if some spook in Asia says, well, you better get rid of TikTok, are you going to just follow that advice or are you just going to think about it of your own accord? No, you're just going to take the advice. I can tell that's what's going to happen. But anyway, James Patterson, on the opposition's national security spokesman, said Australia could not afford to be left behind on the issue and says that the Albanese government should be preparing legislation today. Now, in this article, it goes on, cybersecurity expert Susan McLean said if the bill progresses in the US, Australia should follow suit. Quote, these decisions and the people that are presenting to Congress and the Pentagon are whiz-bang cybersecurity experts. If the American government believes that TikTok is of national security concern, then we, as a friend of America, should realise if it is a risk. If it is a risk in one Western country, then it is a risk in another country. Dear listener, cybersecurity expert Susan McLean, when I read that, she's quoted as saying, these people are whiz-bang cybersecurity experts. My antenna just went off and I'm going, I'm not so sure about the credentials of Susan McLean as a cybersecurity expert. Anyway, she goes on, Australia would have to be mindful of its diplomatic relations with China, but national security must remain the priority. Quote, we are geographically closer to China and we have to be mindful of maintaining diplomatic relations, but if push comes to shove, If the company is acting in a way that risks national security, then that should be the priority, she said. And I'm just thinking to myself, who the fuck is this cybersecurity expert, Susan McLean? In a quick Google, and I'm on her website. She's got a website called Cyber Safety Solutions, where she describes herself as Australia's foremost expert in the area of cyber safety and was a member of Victoria Police for 27 years, widely known as the Cyber Cop. She was the first Victorian police officer appointed to a position involving cyber safety and young people. In 2003, she was the Victoria Police Regional Youth Officer of the Year. She's been awarded the National Medal and the Victorian Police Service Medal and the National Police Medal. And in 1994, she took her first report of cyberbullying involving a group of Year 8 schoolgirls. Blah, 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 blah. In short, dear listener, she's just dealt with cyberbullying of children in high school and other
stuff. She doesn't
like
understand
that.
The technology. She understands its impact in society.
Yes.
It's very, very different.
Exactly. And she's on the face of what is on her website, knows nothing about the topic that we're discussing here. And she's quoted in the Courier Mail as cybersecurity expert, giving her 2 cents worth. This is just the sort of crap that we have to deal with every day from this.
Do you remember there was a big story about thousands of motherboards from China with a secret chip embedded in it?
Yes, yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, so I went and looked that up because I remembered that story. It turns out the manufacturer had built this thing that would automatically download drivers to save you installing them manually, so that your machine would automatically have the latest and greatest drivers, and that if somebody nefarious had got into that supply path, they could automatically push out nasty software to your computer. Right. But there was nothing there was no physical thing on the motherboard.
And no evidence that it had been used for that nefarious purpose. No, it was there just as an aid to software updating.
It was a badly thought out aid in terms of security.
Right.
Not but yes, it had been misreported in one source and other sources had just copied and pasted.
Mm. Let's run through the comments from the most recent going backwards. Watley, oh, whiz bang. Liam, China has actually done some great work in holding out against the tech giants, which are anti-competitive and bad for innovation. Indeed, they have. John Salmon says the bill probably won't pass the courts. Might be held unconstitutional. James says we have our own James Patterson. I think that's most of the comments on that. Well, an hour and a half. This is like the old days, isn't it? And I've still got this whole section of subs, which I'll reserve for next week.
I think we should ban all social media apart from things like Mastodon.
Yeah, well, do we need to ban them? Just let people use them and make up their own mind.
Yeah. It's one of those things, like, you know, I was very early adopter of Facebook, but now I'm just hardly ever in
there. I looked on Facebook recently and I reckon of my news feed, in quotes, 30% is adverts, another 30% is news groups, is groups that I've never joined and it's just decided I might be interested in, and 30% is stuff that I've actually subscribed to.
Well, dear listener, you're lucky. You've subscribed to the Iron Fist Velvet Glove podcast and you've received another 90 minutes of informed commentary. Hope you've enjoyed it. We'll speak to you next week where we'll talk about subs, we'll talk about Israel and Gaza, we'll talk about what the Pope says about Ukraine. You might remember, dear listener, a few months ago, other guys here on this podcast were saying that the counter-offensive would sort things out. And I was
What I actually said was that it's going to be slow going and we've got to see what actually is going to happen from that. Now, it appears that Russia has dug in a hell of a lot stronger than the Ukrainians were anticipating. And now that you've got this situation that the West is foundering on actually supporting Ukraine. So I think that Vladimir Zelensky is going to be forced to go in and do a deal with that bastard, who will actually only use the time and that sort of stuff to build up his forces, and he's going to pinch the whole fucking country. because Putin, he's a prick.
Putin has said all along, all he had to do was outwait the West. The West would get bored.
Mm. Exactly, which is what is happening. You know, and I just think to myself that...
It's a very interesting moment in time where we've had just the US so dominant militarily, and just the idea that, you know, there's other powers out there and they can invade a country and get away with it. And
But they wouldn't have actually attempted that had there been a signatory to the NATO treaty.
Maybe not. But, you know, there's just these challenges to US hegemony. We've got, you know, the US, you know, starts confiscating Iranian oil ships. Well, Iran starts confiscating American oil ships. And you've got, there's a lot of fight back to the idea of the US hegemon. So it's interesting times. And really, you know, a lot of US power or money is tied up in naval power, which is extremely vulnerable, really expensive missiles, which, you know, you sort of run out of quickly in terms of sort of tanks and artillery and stuff, because they've been paying through the nose, overpriced for these defense contracts. They haven't been getting the bang for their buck, even though they've been spending so much money. So the capacity to wage war isn't as great as we might think it is. But anyway, that is all for a discussion next week, because an hour and a half is more than enough. We'll talk to you then. Bye for now.
And it's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from him.
Good night.